Good afternoon. So today I'm going to do exam review. That's going to consist of you ask me questions for things you'd like me to talk about, and I'll talk about them. If you don't ask me about it, I assume you already know it and don't want me to spend time reviewing it. I'm going to collect a bunch of those and then go through all of them together. If we get through all the first round I collect, I'll collect some more. Just first, I just collect topics you'd like me to talk about. Specific questions or something more. So.
Can you do question 5 on the poll for me?
Can you tell me what that's about?
Yeah, it's like a bunch of assembly code, and you have to like say what's in the registers at the end and follow through.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you go over like the bitwise operator?
Anything more specific?
Mainly like the stuff we have on the homework, sort of like using that to manage.
Okay. Yeah.
Timing
with pipelining, like counting cycles or how long a cycle is, or both. Okay. Cycle length plus cycles. Okay. Yeah.
Question 5 on the draw 2016. I think it's up to the
similar
problem.
Okay. I'll probably only do one if they're very similar for time reasons. Plus, yeah. See pointer arithmetic, okay. Rings, okay. Yeah.
Can you go over what's like different parts of the files after compilation, like certain stages? Like
okay, so contents of object files, etc. Okay. Okay, stages and order things happen, okay.
Why do they need an
ALU for call, okay. Yeah.
Can you go over that HCR question on
the register? HCR question on the HCR register.
Can you have like difference between LEA and move?
Yay, okay, yeah.
Can you go over decoding Y86?
Coding Y86, okay.
Like the workflow of push and pop, and then what gets moved to the registers?
Push pop, okay. Push pop, just like the side of the effects of push and pop. Effects on registers, okay. Okay, yeah. Some register and order, okay. Ordering. Okay. Yeah.
Risk
SISC. Okay. And someone back there. Okay.
What do you need to memorize in terms of what
I'm doing? What just did. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Any other topics? So I will move this to the top. Probably decoding up here. Doing this in roughly the order we covered things in class. Trying to group related things together. Oh, yeah, this way earlier. Okay. And that probably goes with timing, stages, and the order things. So these all go here. And okay, and this goes over here, and this grossus goes up here. Okay, so logistics, memorizing thing, what things do you need to memorize? We do not expect you to remember opcode numbers, function code numbers, etc. We will supply a table if you need them. We do expect you to know what types of operands, like registers, how memory locations are specified, that sort of thing, what ID6 takes, but we don't expect you to memorize any numbers. We will supply them if you need them. Register numbers and so on. We also supply, and we will remind, if it matters, we will remind you exactly like where register numbers are and so on. Yeah.
For things we may need to memorize, the like K, G, M, N, D numbers for numbers.
Oh, yes. So question is, like memorizing, yes, we might, you might, K, M, G, T, we might expect you to know. We won't go higher than that.
Okay, so those are the four.
Yeah, those are the only ones. So.
Okay.
Okay. Anything else? Yeah. So I don't expect you to remember which is RA and which is RB, but you should know, if register or displacement plus register to make address, etc. Like that sort of level of detail. But not whether it's RA or RB. Like that we won't require. Yeah. We will supply the table if we require you to know like exactly where things are in the instruction. But I expect you to know, like, what a valid MRMOVEQ instruction would look like in assembly. Yeah.
So we need to know x86
AT&T
syntax.
Do we need to know x86 AT&T syntax? Yes, that may come up.
Okay.
If we just give you assembly snippets, they will be in that syntax. Yes.
Do we need to know Intel syntax?
Do we need to know Intel syntax? No. If we have you write assembly code, we're going to have you write it in AT&T syntax. If you look at our past exams, typically we don't ask questions where that is likely, just mostly for logistical reasons, but if we have you write it, it's going to be in AT&T syntax or like YAD6 code in the YAD-AT&T syntax, because that's all we've seen YAD6 code in. And we probably wouldn't be picky on like if you omitted the percent sign or something like that, because that's not worth anyone's time. Like that's not what we want you to memorize. Okay. So contents of object files, etc. So remember our compilation process as we go to C, C++, etc. source code to assembly. Where in assembly to object files, file to executable. And this first step is compilation. The second step is assembling. And the last step is linking. And so for compilation, after compilation in the assembly, assembly have names for instructions, have labels to indicate functions to call, instructions to jump to global variables to load, etc. So those are all indicated using labels, either labels marking the location of something, like a function beginning, or marking referring to one, like a call of a function uses a label. And so after assembly, assembling into, so this is into assembly, into object file, we have machine code, sort of have data, bytes, which are machine code and initial values of constants plus initial values of globals, plus, and have relocation table entries to represent holes, to fill in bytes, e.g., this is a call, there is a call to printf, to fill in with the location of printf. So that's a relocation table entry, and have symbol table entries to represent labels that might be used elsewhere. So elsewhere, e.g., byte 1000 of this file is where the main function starts. Yeah.
So if in this file we have a label and we have a line that jumps to it, will we just do that jump with the value directly in the machine code, or will we have both those things, the label and the relocation to that label in the relocation?
So the question is, if we have a usage of a label within the function, do we have both of these? And the answer is typically yes. Because usually, it depends what we need, but because typically we need to fill it in with the actual address that thing will end up at, and we might not know that yet. There might be some special cases where we can somehow fill it in earlier, but that's not common.
Okay.
Because we don't know where it's going to end up enough to fill in the hole. And after linking into executable, the linker uses, this is typically from multiple object files. So have data, have bytes to load into memory direct. And this is assuming static linking. With dynamic linking, we do some of the linking process when we loaded the program, so it would be a little less direct. Yeah?
I remember one of the slides when we were talking about this was like, at what stage does it still have the literal ASCII like string character?
Yes.
Could you go into that a little bit?
So if we think about having like a string in our text file, we represent that as a sequence of bytes, which are the ASCII values that appear like in your C source code, like the capital H has an ASCII value E, L, O, O. Those appear as bytes in your C source code. When we convert that into assembly, probably we end up with something like this. And if so, we have a capital H, the byte for that in the assembly file, and E, L, O, O, so the string is still there. If it ends up like that. Does that make sense? Like, conceptually, the compiler might do something silly, like write like code like this, assembly like this. It could do that, but probably it won't. So for the ones after it, we have bytes. We're going to have the bytes of the constants we're going to load. This is going to be a constant, and we're going to represent it the same way we want it to end up in memory. And that's probably as the byte for ASCII capital H, the byte for an E, byte for an L, which is the same way it was represented in the text file. So if we open up the object file in a text editor, we'll see a bunch of unreadable junk and hello world. Because it's the same way it was represented in our original source file as far as that string. Does that make sense?
So
Yeah, so they'll almost likely have the string because on, you know, on a typical system where, you know, it's going to be represented using those same bytes at every step of the way. Like, maybe we have some reason, you know, like what I'm showing up here, to use a different way of representing the string. It has to be there somewhere where we wouldn't do that, like this assembly where I write each byte separately because my compiler wants to be verbose somehow. But probably it's actually represented with those exact bytes because that's what we end up with in memory. Okay, so the next one on C, pointer arithmetic and array. So given, so the key thing to remember is that if we have P of X, this is exactly the same as star dereferencing P plus X. And this goes in both directions. So if we have a pointer that points to element 0 of A, then our pointer points to, and we say do pointer plus equals 2, and then we dereference the pointer. This is the same thing as, you know, what we're dereferencing is A plus 2. Is what we're dereferencing, which is the same thing as P A of 2. And if we say after this did P of 1, then this is equivalent to star P plus 1, which is equivalent to A of 0 plus 2 plus 1, which is equivalent to star, you know, A of 0, move 3 ahead in the array, which is going to be A of 3. Yeah.
So how does the pointer know when it's going forward, right, when it's adding something, to instead of just go like one bit or one byte forward?
So the question is, how does the compiler generate the correct code when we add 2 to the pointer, taking into account what it points to? And the answer is that when we declare the pointer, we're going to declare it something like this. And the compiler, you know, this is how compiler chooses what plus equals does.
So if we have an instar p and we haven't done any array stuff,
yeah,
and we add 1 to instar p, is it going to jump 4 bytes?
Yes, it's going to jump size of int. Yeah, that's how the compiler chooses. It doesn't know it points to an array; it just knows it's an int pointer. Therefore, plus equal is going to treat it like we're advancing by that number of ints. And if you declare it as a different type, it's going to treat it as that type. Okay, other questions? So on sort of strategy for problems like we had in the homework. So what, obviously some of those things take a while to do. We're not going to ask you to do at least many of those during exam time, and certainly for ones where we expect you to look something up in the textbook, we're probably not going to have you do that during the exam, since it's not an open book exam. But general strategy. So the key big things we wanted to do is this mask and shift idea, that if I want to extract, you know, so given, you know, extract bits, you know, say 5 through 9 inclusive from X, first I X and a value with bits 5 through 9 set to 1, because remember that we had this idea that and is keep only certain bits, or clear certain bits, or was set certain bits. That these are things we can think of those operations doing. So or was flip certain bits, where we specify these certain bits specify with a mask, which is a number with that bit set to, with those bits set to 0, 1, depending on exactly what we want to do. In the case of a keeping only certain bits, we want to set the number of bits to 1. So we have for bits 5 through 9, so we'll same with that. So that gets only those bits set, and then we want to make them and make them bits, say 0 through 5, inclusive. So we shift over by 5. We're assuming that bit 0 here is the least significant bit, which is just my convention. You could number the bits differently. Shifting and then doing a right shift to move the bits over. And happily, the AND has cleared the signed bit, so I don't need to worry about whether it's logical or arithmetic. Yes?
So if it's anything other than a signed numeric value, it'll do a logical shift instead of an arithmetic shift?
I'll get to that. Ooh. I'll add that as a topic for later.
So when it does which?
Yeah, so logical or arithmetic. Shift, yep, we need to spell that word, right? Okay, so that. So if we're doing this mask and shift, I need to construct the value with bits 5 through 9 set to 0. So if I'm remembering correctly, that would be 1 and... So 1 and E0, but yeah, you should check my work. And then shift over 5. Or 3 E's. I should actually do this. So 5 through 9 set to 0. So we have 0, 0, 0 as the last 4 bits. We have 0 and 1. 1, 1, 1. And then we have 1, 1. So that should be 3, 0. Yeah.
On the exam, can we just like write out that number instead of like converting it to hex in our heads?
No. If we ask you to write C code, then no, because you can't write a constant like that in C code. If we are specifying a different way, maybe you could. So that's the mask and shift. So that usually for our bit puzzles, the first step is use this strategy to extract the parts of the number we care about. And the other part was sort of a divide and conquer, like for each piece of the number we care about, figure out how to transform. Transform, so this can mean shift to the location we want it, add it, you know, turn it into a, you know, a bias, say 0 or minus, e.g. 0 or minus 1 or 0 or 0 or 1 or 0 or minus 1, something that we want, some value we want based on what that part of the number is, depending on the problem we have. But the general strategy, like figure out the piece, figure out what you want to do to that particular piece, and figure out what operations might do that based on the suite of operations we have. And unfortunately, I need more specific problems to know, to give specific examples that you had most of the common types of cases in the homework. But the key thing is this mask and shift and dividing it into pieces, that if we need to like swap two pieces, you extract one piece, you extract the other piece, then you use the OR operator typically to OR them together, to you know, compute one piece and set those bits in the other piece, so now you have your whole value. Yes?
What?
Can I write, the question is, can I write this 0B111 11000 or without the underscores. Zero, and the answer is not in C. Like, I will understand what you mean, but it's not valid C. Okay, other questions? Okay, then LEA versus move. So, one way of thinking about LEA that we couldn't have done earlier in the semester is that if we think of our processor, we have our, so we have our processor, so we have our PC, and we have our register file, and then we have our ALU, and then we have our data memory. Oh, we have our instruction memory. That's important. This is what I, so we have our PC and our instruction memory. Then we have our data memory. And if we think about an and we take a value from that. And you can think about the that if this is what the sort of the memory to register move does, our LEA is doing this instead. Memory to register, yeah. So this is the address input here. The LEA is just taking that address we would have moved and sending it to the register file directly. That's one way of thinking about the LEA instruction. That idea makes sense to start out?
Yeah.
Why does it go to the ALU? So if you remember, like, we have, like, move, like, this is our move instruction. Remember, it goes in this direction in TNT syntax. We have to compute that 10 plus RAX address. Or sometimes in x86, like, not y86, we might have to do something more complicated. And that will use the ALU. So this is one way of thinking about it. So basically, we're just doing what we would do for a memory to register move instruction, but we're taking that address line and skipping the data memory. So LEA blank into RAX is similar, is like move blank into RAX, where something with the, some memory location, but skip memory access of move shortcut that address value direct into register file writes. So examples are that LEA RAX RBX is the same as, if that was a move instruction, that would move from memory at RAX using that address into RBX. So this is the same as move RAX into RBX. LEA 1 RAX RBX, if this was a move instruction, would add 1 to RAX access memory there and put it in RBX. So here we get the address we get by adding one. RBX becomes RAX plus one. And similarly, we have the other ways of specifying memory address. This is RCX becomes RAX plus RBX because memory at. And we have some more variants like that. And if you remember the full version. So if this were a move RAX RBX would read from memory at address RAX, value of RAX. And we're not doing the read from memory, but we're taking that same address we computed. And so it's skipping in the sense that we're taking the reg shortcut past the data memory. That we would send a value to the data memory, but we're a move, we're just taking this shortcut where that value goes directly to the register file. Okay. Other questions? So then we had, RISC versus CISC. So in instruction sets, we have traces which are, instruction set design choices can make it easier, harder to make hardware, easier, harder to make to write assembly. RISC generally tries to make hardware simpler to design, assuming that making assembly making assembly harder to write, you require more instructions is okay. And sort of the basic philosophy was that, let the compiler do it. It's sort of what RISC is doing. So if you think of something where we're letting the compiler do something, it doesn't. So this means that RISC has things that make the hardware simpler. So we have fixed length instructions are a common thing that RISC does because that's simpler to decode in hardware. Makes the hardware much simpler to design, but it means that maybe we have less flexibility as far as the types of instructions we can have, so it might be harder to write assembly. It means our programs are going to have more instructions, more space taken up, because even our simple instructions are going to take up the same amount of space as our more complicated ones, like ones which have like constants in them, are going to be as long as the ones which don't. Another thing is they generally have less instructions. It's easier to make hardware that implements less instructions, so they're going to have less, even though it sure would be more convenient to have instructions for all sorts of operations you might want to do. The RISC philosophy is going to say, let the compiler write those with multiple instructions. We'll typically have separate instructions for accessing memory, because it turns out it's annoying to have hardware where you do an add and also access memory. We've seen like a hardware design where that would be a lot more complicated with our single cycle processor, where we need to like have two ALUs or somehow, you know, use the ALU for one thing and then another, probably in separate cycles. So it simplifies the hardware in that respect, but the consequence is now the compiler needs to load values to and from memory explicitly rather than being able to conveniently use them all the time. That's something that the compiler can do, but it's more annoying if you're writing assembly. And a consequence of this is more registers to hold values to make up for this. So you don't write so many instructions that access memory. They just load and store values from memory. Those were the big things. So the big thing is, you know, easier, simpler hardware, you know, that versus CISC, the opposite, is going to have more complicated instructions. You know, CISC has, you know, more complicated instructions. I guess other thing is one way of specifying operands. So like Y86 took this to an extreme. It had an add instruction that took two registers. You wanted to add an immediate, you needed more instructions. And that they just decided that was what they were going to do because that simplifies the hardware. Now we have less things to worry about in our implementing our add instruction. But the cost is the compiler now needs to generate extra code to deal with that and has less flexibility. So more complicated instructions, often designed for, you know, making particular things convenient in assembly. So a big factor in CISC-like designs is that they want the assembly to be convenient and they'll add instructions to do that. Being less concerned compared to RISC about how hard is this to implement, am I making my hardware as simple as possible, sort of where RISC was going. And something I mentioned is that, you know, it's a fuzzy line, you know, very few ISAs are definitely RISC or definitely CISC. So they're just, you know, they're essentially the only, like, definitely RISC ISA is MIPS, and the only definitely CISC ISA is like VAX. Everything else, you know, is not all the way over on that extreme, and you'll usually find a mix of features of both. Anything I should clarify? Yeah, so the question is, RISC would make compiler creation more challenging? Yeah, so it would make it more challenging in the sense that you have to you're going to have to generate more assembly instructions. It won't make it more challenging in the sense that if you care about your compiler using all the instructions, of course CISC is harder. Because there's more of them. But in the sense of just generating a compiler to generate some working code is going to be harder because, for example, on a RISC machine, one of the, you know, less instructions is generally, a big thing is simpler instructions. So generally no instructions that write to values, for example, which means no pop, right? That would be an unusual thing in a RISC machine. So now your compiler needs to generate, you know, two instructions for every pop and so on. Other questions? Yeah.
Can I ask a question about ALU?
So the question is, what is this? So LEA REX RBX is a syntax error. At least I hope it is. Syntax error, I hope. Shouldn't assemble. Okay, so risk versus CISC. Okay, so endianness of YD6, it's little endian if it ever, whenever it comes up. Anytime you need to know about endianness, it's little endian. Sometimes you don't need to know. So as for decoding YD6, so our procedure is that hopefully you'll have, you need the table of opcodes, etc. So given a table like, say, like say this one, you'll look at the table and you say, you look at the first byte and you say, okay, I look at the top 4 bits, the most significant 4 bits of the first byte, and that tells me which line of the table it is. And then you look where each of the fields lines up. So it's, take our, where did I put? So table has which byte, you know, has bytes of instructions labeled. Look in first byte for matching opcode. Then table tells you which byte number of each instruction you look at. Which byte of each instruction contains important values. Fill in, you know, just match the blanks. So match the blanks in the, you know, bytes of the instruction. Blanks, two bytes, two values in bytes of instruction. And we will definitely have our table like the one in the book labeled with, like, this is byte 0 of the instruction, this is byte 1, so there's no confusion on what order are things written in. You know, it will be labeled like it was in my example here. You know, where we have, this is byte 0 is here, byte 1 is here. We will have it labeled byte by byte. We're not going to have you be confused about where is which. I'll take care first.
So then does, like, in decoding, does little endian not affect?
So the question is, does little endian affect this? So endianness, remember, is about the order of things we've numbered in a larger value. And on this table, everything here is half a byte except for these green values. So those are affected by endianness, because we want to get an 8-byte value out of 8 different bytes with numbers. We need to figure out, well, byte 1 of 1 through 8 or byte 2 of 2 through 9, what part of the number is that? We use little endian to know that, and know that the first part is the least significant part of them. The byte 2 or 1 of those instructions is the least significant part of that constant. Yeah.
So if I'm start getting this int from RA, and let's say we're at an RR move cube, right? Or an RM move cube, sure.
So you're saying, so you're saying if I start extracting an int?
Like int x equals i10 bytes of RA, and so it'll get a whole 4 bytes, but we're just giving it one address.
So,
I should find an exam question.
Sorry. Okay. Oh, that's what I did. Okay. Okay. There we go.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
We'll try this, and then we'll move on if this doesn't work. So, yes.
Yes. So can we go back to the thing? If the stack pointer is pointing to an instruction, and
yeah,
it's pointing to, like, the first byte in that instruction, and I say pop, right, so get the value at the stack pointer, what am I going to get? Am I going to get, like, RARB40, am I going to get RARBD, am I going to get RARBD?
Okay, so your question is about, really about question 5 on fall 2018, I believe. If I remember that correctly. I don't usually memorize my exams by question number, especially since we randomize the question order. so it doesn't come up when writing the exam. But question six. Okay, so we'll get there. We'll get to that when we talk about question five first. Or, yeah. So the question is, it's written in, what do you mean by written in Big Endian?
Like, if, like, well, like, one of the sites that's supposed, like, at address, like 123, it, like, started with, like, what is it, 2, 3, and then...
So what's 2, 3 in 123, hex 123? Is it the least or most significant part of the number?
2, 3, it's,
the least significant part, which is at the lowest address in Little Endian. If it was in Big Endian, we'd have the most significant part of the number in the first, in the lowest address. So it would start with 00.
Wouldn't it be like 0000 and then the last two bytes, last two like parts would be 2, 3, and then
01? No. So even though, okay, so this is a Endianness issue. So if we have, where is my screen? So Endianness. So OX123 is the same as OX0000123, right? Agreed? Is the same as OX0000000000123, right? And this is the least significant byte of the byte is here. The next least significant byte is here. The next least significant byte is here, and so on. So if we write this as Little Endian, that is the least significant byte at lowest address. Lowest address, so address, so address 0 is going to have hex 2, 3. Address 1 is going to have hex 1. Address 0, 2 is going to have 0, 0, and so on. I think people often really want to think it's significant if we don't write the leading zeros, but it doesn't change anything. It better not change anything. Okay. So let's do, let me actually figure out how to pull up questions, website, 5 on fall 2018, key 1E. So question 5, fall 2018, so I'll so if we take the question, it's so this has this assembly, this listing of assembly. And question 5 is, what is RSP? So we'll start with that, and we'll go to the next part, which, so what is RSP? So let's say, let's track the values of registers. So after we run this IRMOVEQ, RSP becomes hex 030. After we run this, RAX becomes OX25. After we do the subtract, RSP becomes RSP minus RAX. Because it's subtract from, which is going to be the same as 30 minus OX25, which turns out is OXB, I believe. I'm going to check because I don't like making errors. Yeah, so it's OXB 11. Okay, then we do a pop, and this pop does two things. So we'll talk about the second part, which was your question. But one of the things it does is it It removes something from the stack goes down, so that increments the stack pointer. And remember, it's pop Q, so it's 8 bytes. So this is REX becomes memory at OXB, and RSP becomes RSP plus 8. Because we point to, we increment the stack pointer because we decrement to make it grow, we increment to make it shrink. So it becomes RSP plus 8, and that's going to be equal to 11 plus 8 is 19, or which is one of the hex 03. So X13, which is 19 in decimal. So as for the value we read, so the stack pointer pop takes the thing that's currently being pointed to the stack and puts it in the register. So it's at OXB is where that value comes from. So the way the question set up says that this is a listing of bytes starting at the address before the colon. So 30 is at address 0. Hex F4 is at address 1. Hex 30 is at address 2, and so on. So at address OXA is 30. At address OXB is F0, OXC is 25, and so on. And REX is 8 bytes. We're going to read 8 bytes, and it's going to start at address OXB. So it's going to be this, 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 and all the way up to here. That's 8 bytes. And those are 8 bytes starting from the lowest address to the highest, but we're going to interpret that as a little endian value because we always use a little endian. And this is therefore the least significant part, lowest address. So it's going to be something ending in hex 25 and hex F0, and the second least significant part is the 25. And everything else is zeros. So that's the value we get. Okay, yes?
Let's say we have a label in front of, let's say, one of the zombie items. Where were the labels defined? Like, specific record?
So the question is, when we have a label, and we use that label elsewhere. In Y86, we always represent that label with the address of the first byte of the instruction that is immediately after the label. Okay, other questions on this? And I think this is probably similar to what the other question is doing, because it's usually where people are having these problems. Yeah. The question is, will I post this text file? Yes. Yeah.
Another question, if we're using push instead of pop, do you subtract 8 from RSP?
Question, would push subtract 8 from RSP? Yes. Question is, if we're doing MR move Q, would we move 8 bytes? Yes. In Y86, all our instructions that access memory, as an operand, always access 8 bytes. No exceptions. Other questions? Okay. So then the HCL register question on the quiz. So let me pull up the HCL code from the quiz. Here. So the code looked like this. I initially keyed this wrong because didn't run it in HCLRS, which is what I should have done to check my answer, rather than relying on what I had scribbled on some piece of paper. So the way I figure this out is that we're told that during cycle zero, so we have cycle zero, we have y, foo equals one, y bar equals one, the initial values. And based on that, we can figure out what x foo and x bar are. So x foo equals y foo plus y bar, which are current, which is 1 plus 1, which is 2. X bar is x foo plus 1, which is 1 plus 1 plus 1, which is 3. And then we have a rising edge of the clock, which is going to copy x foo to y foo, etc. Because that's how registers work. Their input gets copied to their output at the rising edge of the clock. So during cycle 1, we'll have y foo is 2, y bar is 3, the previous inputs. And we'll do the same computation. X foo is y foo plus y bar. And if we look in this cycle, we have two plus three, or five. X bar is x foo plus one, which is five as they're about plus one, which is six. So then we have another rising edge of the clock. So during cycle two, we know that y foo is the copied value, and we could stop there because that's what the question was asking for. Could figure everything out. So something worth noting is that, you know, our inputs just have, like, our inputs have a particular value, and that value doesn't affect the output values, the y values, until the next rising edge of the clock. Yes, your question?
Yeah, so how come x foo is, like, updated before the, like, how come when you calculate x bar, you use, like, the updated version of x foo?
Okay, so the question is, why am I using the updated version of x, the current version of x foo? So during any cycle, y foo and x foo have exactly one value. So something worth noting is, remember when we talked about HCL, we mentioned that if I did this, they have the same effect. The order doesn't matter. So x foo and x bar and y foo and y bar in each cycle have exactly one value. We just need to figure out what that is. There's no notion of the current or previous value. Just during a cycle, we start with the outputs of registers, our y values, which were set because of the previous cycle. And everything else we just determine by looking for the value. So our process is, here, I need to know what x bar is. To do that, I need to figure out what x foo is. Let me look for where x foo is set. And I say, okay, x foo is set here. To know that, I need to know where y foo and y bar are set. Their register outputs, I have their values. They're fixed for the whole cycle. And they were set when we had the rising edge of the clock start the cycle. So it's not like there's an old value of x foo. There's the value for the cycle, which is one value. Is that clearer? Other questions on this? Yeah.
Follow up on that, can I ask about question two, which is the why RAX register is changing to the same place?
Okay, and what part are you confused by? Like, which answer are you expecting to be correct that isn't, or vice versa? Register input M. So that's a sketchy one, but it's because it's not supposed to change registers at all. We probably don't do that by setting the input value. We set it, do it by setting the register number to indicate don't write to anything. And I probably should be avoiding skipping ahead of myself since I have more topics to talk about in my last 15 minutes. And I'll have another round if we don't run out of time here. So, stages and the order things happen, and push-pop effects and the ordering of operations. So stages. So we had two types of stages we cared about. We had our sort of fake / conceptual stages for the single cycle CPU. in the single cycle CPU, things happened because of dependencies. Things happened because of dependency, happened in order, in an order because of dependencies. We can't read RBX for add RBX RBX until we read the instruction to find out that it's RBX and not RAX. So there's a dependency there that the register read has to happen after we read the instruction because we can't know what to read otherwise. Similarly, if we have like a memory instruction and we know where the memory instruction accesses memory based on computing something with a value from a register, we have to read the register before we can read memory. We don't know where to read. And things happen in order because of, in addition to dependencies, we have just some things are updates triggered by the rising edge of the clock. So we had some events which were triggered by the rising edge clock. So this is all our updates. So our reads are just dependencies. We need to have the thing we need to know what we're reading before we can read it. For otherwise, and that determines an order, that means that sometimes we can't like read the register until we read the instruction. We can't read memory until we read the register to know where to read memory. But for updates, they're all triggered by the rising edge of the clock. This is our single cycle CPU. So questions about that? So that's when things happened. So stages were just an organizational tool that sometimes matched up to the dependency order, C order. And sometimes they might not. You have to look at what things are connected to what. That's how you return the order for the single cycle CPU, or what things care about the clock signal. Then for our pipeline CPU, stages were the actual order things happened because we saved results of prior stage in pipeline registers before starting the next stage. So in that case, we actually had an order because we had these pipeline registers where we said, we're not going to do the memory access until after we save the results of the ALU operation in a register, in these pipeline registers. And that means they have to happen in exactly that order. So it's actually an order in our pipeline processor because we've enforced it with these pipeline registers. And in this case, our stages were fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. I probably should do fetch, which is read instruction memory plus compute address of next instruction, decode, plus compute next PC with the question, with special cases for jumps, return, which we won't talk about. We haven't talked about how that works, but something needs to happen for jump and return. We'll talk about after the exam. Decode was read the register file. Execute was use the ALU. Memory was use the data memory. And write back was write to the register file. And those were the stages our textbook has chosen. We could have chosen other stages, but this is the set they found convenient for doing pipelining. Okay, so push-pop effects on registers and ordering operations and the ALU for call. So push-pop-call-return. Push-pop-call-return all need to compute a new stack pointer. This is what they'll use the ALU for. At least in our textbook's design. In our textbook's design, they all use the ALU to do that. So that's how we compute addresses. Okay, and push. So in the case of push, we compute a new stack pointer and write to the new location. In the case of pop, we compute a new stack pointer and read from the old location, the one that we, before we changed it. And the way this works with pop is that we're going to the ALU's output will be written to our RSP because it's the new stack pointer. And the data memory's input will come from the old RSP, not the ALU. Can't come from the ALU because then we'd read from the wrong place. So it has to come from the old RSP, i.e. from the register file directly, more directly. So the question is, what order does it happen in? So our circuit is going to be so we're going to have our PC. So in the single cycle processor, we're going to, for the other one, it's actually a little more straightforward. So we have our register file, and we're going to have our ALU, and we're going to have this shortcut for the, we're going to have the ALU, and for the, this is what's relevant to the add instruction, the memory, the instruction memory, which I forgot again. We're going to take this value out. So, and this, I'm going to go into here. So we're going to have these two values coming into the register file, and the answer is, well, these two components can work at the same time, for pop. For pop, like, there's not a dependency between them. They're not, like, one doesn't depend on the other. So in the single cycle processor, they'll happen at the same time. That doesn't actually help us because our critical path assumes we have both in sequence. So it's not going to make our processor any faster to observe this. But for pop, they, like, could happen at the same time. For a single cycle CPU. For a pipeline CPU, we're going to have pipeline registers in between, so we're going to enforce that we first do the ALU thing, then we do the memory thing in that order, so we force it to happen in a particular order. For pop, for single cycle CPU only. And that's because there's no connection between ALU and memory that's active for the pop instruction. For like MR move Q, yeah, there is. There's the ALU output is the memory address input. Okay, questions about that? I have so many topics. Okay. So timing with a Python, cycle length and number of cycles. So the cycle length is the length of longest path from register to state to register, or register to memory, or register to register file. You know, it's the longest path, one of those paths. For any type of register, including pipeline registers, which intuitively for pipeline CPU, it's the slowest stage. That determines our pipeline length, you know, including pipeline register time. That determines our cycle length. For the number of cycles, the way I like figuring out as far as how long things take is, well, if we think of having, say, code execute write back, say this two-stage CPU, we have instruction A is in fetch, then it's in decode. This is cycle 0. Then it's during cycle 1, it's in execute. 3. So we had 4 cycles to finish each instruction, but once things get going, we're finishing 1 instruction every cycle. So if we have a B after A, it will finish during cycle 4. If we have C after that, it will finish during cycle 5. And if you think about, okay, and so if you want to figure out when do things start and stop, you know that you have this extra time. Basically, we have 3 things that the first 3 instructions finish, started here, and then we need an extra 3 cycles for the last instruction to make it all the way through the pipeline. And if we think about our latency and throughput, we have, once things are started, 1 instruction finishes per cycle, or alternately, 1 instruction starts per cycle, and it takes, plus extra 3 cycles to get for first instruction to finish, or extra 3 cycles for last instruction. For last instruction to finish, depending on which view you're taking, whether you're looking at the beginning or the end. That's how you think of what's the total time. And when we have lots of instructions, those extra cycles don't matter very much of the starting and stopping. And we can think of that the throughput is this 1 per cycle, time for many. And our latency is 4 cycles for each instruction. And then let's say our slowest stage was, say, e.g., was, say, 200 picoseconds. Then we'd say, okay, that would be, our latency would be 800 picoseconds. The total time for these 3 instructions would be 3 cycles to start each of them plus 3 cycles for the last to finish, which would be 6 times 200 equals 1200 picoseconds. And the throughput would be 1 instruction. Once things get started, every 200 picoseconds is the throughput of the processor, once things are going. Questions on timing? Expecting more questions. Okay. So a logical versus arithmetic shift. So in C compilers, we care about this is a logical shift if X is unsigned, a arithmetic shift if X is signed. Arithmetic shift copies the sign bit to the shifted in bits. Logical shift always shifts in zeros. So this arithmetic shift is divide by power of 2 round towards negative infinity for signed is divide by power of 2 for unsigned. Get weird results for sign. Get weird non-mathematical results if thinking as signed and negative. Because we flip the sign bit and get some huge number from a small unsigned, from a small negative number. Yeah?
So if we have, for example, a char, which one's it gonna do?
The question is, if we have a char, which one's it gonna do? So we won't ask you, because this is very confusing. So there's several reasons it's confusing. So one reason it's confusing is because char is sometimes signed and sometimes not. Another reason it's confusing is because it turns out that C likes converting things to ints implicitly when they're smaller than ints sometimes.
Okay. Is there anything other than ints that we'll need to do this with?
So any signed type, signed integer type, explicitly signed integer type should follow these rules. Question is, can you do this with floating points? I mean, it makes sense to shift floating point numbers in registers, but if you want to do that in C, you're going to have to write it in a weird casts.